Mr. Weezen,
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. You are here representing
City of Omaha.
And very good, is it? Ms. Svein? Good morning to you, and you are representing? Very good. So, Mr. Domina, we are going to give you 10 minutes, and we are going to give each of the other parties 10 minutes. And we will give the city time to respond to you, and then we will give you your rebuttal time, if you have any, and then we'll go to Ms. Spain. Everybody understand that?
Yes, sir.
Very good. With that, Mr. Domina,
thank you.
You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you very much. I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Trevor Dion, whose brother was shot and killed by an Omaha police officer who was attempting to effectuate a lawful arrest. By definition, that means that the police officer did not commit an intentional tort. The trial court found an intentional tort and dismissed this case on that basis. The trial court committed an error. It needs to be reversed for that reason, and that reason alone is sufficient for the reversal. There are really interesting issues in this case about the use of force, about the victimization of a bystander, and about reasonable conduct. I'll spend most of my time on those issues. In this context, my client enjoyed a special relationship with the Omaha Police Department. He was with the department pursuant to a contract signed by the mayor of Omaha inviting him to be there. The police chief signed it. The invitation said, you can ride with our cruisers, you can be with our officers, you obey our rules, you do what we say, we have control of your conduct. We are responsible for you. There is an insurance provision that I'm not interested in. The other parties are. That was the context in which these two young men, one of whom is my client's deceased brother, were passengers in the back seat of a cruiser responding to a report of a burglary in process.
Did the production company approach the city, or did the city approach the production company? And does that make any difference to your special status argument?
I'll answer that this way. I don't know. And from my perspective, I don't think it makes any difference and is of no consequence. All of the matters that affect my client's death arise after the contract is negotiated, after the contact, all of those things, it all arises out of what happened at the time of the killing.
If this court were to disagree with your assessment of the arising from a battery, how does that affect your special relationship argument?
Makes it inconsequential because I lose.
Okay.
If that's your finding, I think I lose. I don't think the special relationship matters.
So you have that ledge that to stand on its own in any matter.
I think, Your Honor, I have to win this way. I have to win on the basis that the intentional tort exception to the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act does not apply because, by definition, a law enforcement officer engaged in a lawful arrest cannot commit an intentional tort of battery. Can't happen. We think that's what you held in Phillips versus Liberty Mutual, and there's lots of law to that effect.
Let's talk about Phillips real quick. Did the court actually base its decision upon sovereign immunity, or did it just take another tack?
In Phillips, I don't think that the court, I think there were two paths to the decision. I think the clearer one was that there was an intentional tort. That there was no intentional tort in Phillips. And then I think there's confusing language in the opinion about the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, and that's what caused the problem here. The Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act arises when a tort has occurred, and then the question is that tort one for which the state has or has not waived sovereign immunity? The state has not waived sovereign immunity for intentional torts. When a police officer effectuating a lawful arrest uses force, by definition, the police officer has a privilege to use that force for the public good.
There is no intent to commit a harm. There is nothing to transfer. In this case, there is no intentional tort.
But isn't talking about justification getting out a little ahead of your skis? I mean, justification exists to excuse or to make lawful what would otherwise be an assault or battery, correct? Both in the criminal context and under our statutory scheme in civil cases.
Yes, I agree with that, but I'm not talking about justification. I'm talking about whether or not the fundamental elements of a tort are present, which, if present, give rise to the question, is this a tort with respect to which the state has waived sovereign immunity, or is it not? It's A or B. But first, there has to be a tort. If you decide there's sovereign immunity first, you never get to that subject. What is it that the legislature allows citizens to sue for?
So why is this not a tort? It was intentional.
It wasn't intentional. It was.
It was a harmful contact.
I disagree with that.
Let me back up. If we're talking about the suspect, the robbery suspect, if they shoot at the robbery suspect and strike that suspect, that was intentional. It caused a harm. They struck him. Why is that not a tort? And then does become a privilege justification after that?
I've been grateful all my life that I don't practice law in French because they have fewer words than we do, but sometimes we don't have enough. And this is such a case. Your Honor, where there is an intentional shooting, that is an act that is intended to occur. The impact on the victim causes an injury to the victim. We have confused that with this idea of harm in intentional torts, because the tort process inherently, even in the acts that are intentional, involves a weighing of interests. And that balancing of interests is the social utility of that firing, even with a bodily injury to the intended person who is suspected of having committed a crime. It has to be a lawful arrest, or this doesn't apply.
And I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. Let me see if I can clarify something. What is your understanding of intentional tort within this immunity discussion? Must the intentional tort be done for immunity to arise by a government employee, such as police, or does the intentional tort anywhere in the picture, such as a robber, qualify? Under that statute, what is the tort? Who is the actor within the statutory language for which immunity would adhere?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is the actor is the person whose conduct would give rise to liability if waived by the sovereign. And that, in this case, is the police officer. And so in this case, again, if the police officer is effectuating a lawful arrest, the officer has the authority to touch and even to wrestle to the ground, hold on the ground, handcuff, restrain, if necessary, shoot and kill the suspect. That's not a tort.
How do you reconcile this with the Britton City of Crawford case?
Britton's wrong. Britton needs to be distinguished or overruled in this case, because in Britton, clearly the court did decide that there was an intentional tort, and from my perspective, ran over the top of the distinction for which I argue.
I understand. What is your argument for how it should be distinguished?
Your Honor, I would distinguish it this way, and I don't think the court has done this with the clarity for which I argue. I think the court needs to make it clear that for sovereign immunity to arise, something has to have occurred to evaluate in terms of the waiver. Is this a tort? Is it a tort for which sovereign immunity was waived, or is it not? But not, well, it's just an intentional act and they're all out. Because if you do that, you've eliminated from the theory of recovery the possibility that you outlined carefully in Phillips versus Liberty Mutual, which is while effectuating a lawful arrest, an injury to a bystander is actionable if the conduct of the police officer is unreasonable.
So is it an unlawful touching versus a lawful touching?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. And the distinction is the criminal conduct or reasonably suspected criminal conduct.
So if there's lawful touching by the officer, it cannot be a tort.
That's my view. And in that case, you just don't get to sovereign immunity.
If the officer's conduct was privileged for the purpose of the battery, would it not also be privileged for the purposes of the ordinary negligence?
In this case, I think that it was up to the point where if you watch Exhibit 24, the escaping suspect is running with his back out the door, and there are 24 shots fired into the vestibule where my client is standing. In the direction of the University of Nebraska Medical Center, the Clarkson Hospital, the Clarkson College, and Dodge Street, which is exactly what you foresaw in Phillips. We ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiesen, good morning to you. And Mr. Wiesen, you understand you've got 10 minutes to handle all sides of the city's arguments.
I do, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Wiesen, and I'm an assistant city attorney for the city of Omaha. I'd like to begin my time today by discussing something that has not been discussed so far, causation. There are four necessary elements of negligence: duty, breach, causation, and damages. Causation is a required element of negligence, and the district court made findings regarding causation in its July 11th, 2019 order. These findings can be found in the transcript on pages 85 and 86. However, the estate failed to assign any error to the district court's findings of causation. So the estate could prevail on battery, the estate could prevail on breach, and the estate could prevail on duties today, but the appeal would still fail as a matter of law because the estate never filed any assignments of error to this court on the issue of causation. And I think that's important for this court to consider. I'd also like to highlight the standard of review that's before this court. Because this was a trial under the Nebraska Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act, the factual findings of the trial court cannot be disturbed unless they are clearly wrong. This standard requires this court to consider the judgment in the light most favorable to the city of Omaha and to resolve all evidentiary conflicts in favor of the city.
So you're saying about failure proof of causation, that was one of the district court's positions?
Yes, the district court made findings on causation at pages 85 and 86 of the transcript, and the estate never assigned any of those findings as error in this case, and that's fatal to their appeal today. The Nebraska legislature partially abrogated the sovereign immunity of the city when it passed the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act. However, the legislature did not waive all of the city's sovereign immunity. It retained several instances of it through the exceptions contained in Nebraska Revised Statute 13-910. At issue in the appeal today is what is commonly referred to as the intentional torts exception found in Nebraska Revised Statute 13-910, subsection 7. In relevant part, this section or subsection bars any claims against the city that arise out of assault and battery. It doesn't just bar claims of assault or claims of battery. It bars all claims that arise out of those two intentional torts. The Nebraska Supreme Court, this court, has defined the intentional tort of battery in Britton v. Crawford. And I think that definition is illustrative to the case at hand. It said in part that an actor, in this case, the police officer or the city, is subject to liability to another, in this appeal, the estate, for battery if A, the police officer acts intending to cause a harmful or offensive contact with a person of the other, Dion, or a third person, the suspect in this case, Cortez Washington, or an imminent apprehension of such contact, and B, a harmful contact with a person of the other, Dion, directly or indirectly results. And that's what we have here today. Under the standard for battery articulated by this court in Britton v. Crawford, those elements are clearly met and a battery occurred. Sovereign immunity, therefore, bars the estate's claims against the city in this appeal.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument based upon Phillips?
I believe that the court is bound to strictly interpret statutes that waive sovereign immunity against the waiver of sovereign immunity and in favor of the government. And in Phillips, it's my understanding that I believe the court had trouble with the nature of the contact between the student and the teacher. The student, when the student realized that the deputies were there to arrest the student, fled. While the officers were pursuing that student, the officers inadvertently knocked the teacher into the wall. And that's contact that that contact with the teacher is very different than what their intention was with the student at that time. They had not yet reached the student. And so you have different contact with different individuals that are not relevant in space or time or nature. And I think that was how we can distinguish Phillips from this case.
Did this court decide in Phillips that the district court's decision on sovereign immunity was wrong?
I'm sorry?
When this court decided the Phillips matter, did it decide that the district court's finding that sovereign immunity was not waived was wrong?
I don't believe that the district court in this appeal held that this court's findings in Phillips
I'm
was
sorry, my question is completely confusing. I misled you on that one. When we decided Phillips, in that opinion, did that opinion actually say that the district court in that case was wrong for finding that sovereign immunity had not been waived?
I don't specifically recall. I believe that there was a discussion and there were essentially two tracks. This court in Phillips did not find that the district court erred in finding that sovereign immunity barred the plaintiff's claims in Phillips. It found that there was a different analysis that the court wanted to apply, a reasonableness analysis, and that was the basis for affirming the court's decision. But I don't believe that there is any express finding by this court in Phillips that the district court erred in relying on sovereign immunity.
Was there tension between
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman, and maybe you can simplify things for me. What is the intentional tort upon which you rely? Who did what?
Battery, Your Honor. In this case, the facts proven at trial show that all three officers intended to make a harmful contact with Cortez Washington, the suspect in this, under the definition of battery articulated in Britton v. Crawford, a third person, and that the harmful contact was occasioned upon the person of the other, in this case, Dion.
So the officers engaged in the battery, is that your statement?
Yes, Your Honor, they intended to cause that harmful contact to Mr. Washington.
Was it authorized?
Yes, they were acting in self-defense. When they encountered Mr. Washington, he pointed what appeared to be a very real handgun at them, pulled the trigger, and it simulated discharge. All officers felt that their lives and the lives of the other people in the restaurant were in danger, and they responded with deadly force.
So is that a battery if you're authorized?
Yes. Yes, it is, Your Honor. The difference between being privileged to take action does not take, whether or not you're privileged, it's still a battery. You have to first establish whether battery or negligence occurred, and then you decide if there's any privilege to the individuals taking that action. There are two separate analyses.
In fact, in Britain, didn't we say expressly, there is no need in applying the assault and battery exception to ask about justification or privilege. It's simply unnecessary.
That's correct.
Is there tension between Brittany and Phillips?
I think if you look at this court's decisions as a whole on battery and the intentional torts exception and its application, I think there may be some tension between Phillips and the rest of this court's case law on the matter. Again, this court in Phillips never specifically stated that sovereign immunity and then the intentional torts exception didn't apply. It only found another way for this court to affirm the decision of the district court. I think if you look at this court's most recent holdings and opinions on the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act, the State Tort Claims Act, and the Intentional Torts Exception, they are all uniform in finding that the waiver of sovereign immunity must be strictly construed in favor of the government and against the waiver. And given the facts that were determined by the district court, this court cannot, on the one hand, find that the intentional torts exception does not apply while also stating that the waiver against sovereign immunity was strictly construed in this case.
Before your time runs out, do you want to touch on your indemnification argument?
Just briefly, Your Honor, the important part of the contract states that Langley Productions agreed to indemnify and defend the city against all claims for injury to or death of persons. And that's different than when they agreed to indemnify and defend the city for all claims of damage to or destruction of property arising out of the acts of Langley and its employees. That language, express language in the contract shows an explicit understanding between the parties that there's a difference between all claims for injury into or death and just claims for destruction of property that arise out of specific conduct of specific individuals or people. With that, I see my time is almost up. The city prays that the court affirms the judgment of the district court in dismissing the claims of the estate against the city and overrules the judgment of the district court.
I beg your pardon. I did have one more question. I beg your pardon. So is a battery an intentional tort?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And just a second, if I could finish up my prayer for relief quickly.
You may.
And the city also respectfully prays that this court overturn the decision of the district court in granting Langley Productions' motion for summary judgment against the city of Baltimore. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, do we have rebuttal time for Mr. Domina?
20 seconds.
We'll give you a minute, Mr. Domina.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try not to use it all, but I appreciate it. The causation matter is dealt with in the trial court's opinion on pages 43 and 44 of the opinion. As you read what it did on the causation issue, you'll read that the trial court found there was no proof that there was a cause and effect link between the failure to train or the failure to issue directions to my client at the time of the event and his death. There's not a breath there about the shooting. So I disagree with the city attorney on that point.
So the causation issue that you brought up is more to the special relationship as opposed to the actual cause of death.
Well, it's to the special relationship that occurred inside that restaurant and the use of firearms during the course of that event, not to what we alleged there were problems with what happened before out in the car and in the policies. The court found against us on that. That's the only causation disposition in the opinion. We assigned as error the reversal and dismissal of our complaint. Now, one more thing. If every police shooting is always a battery, the city has thrown its officers under the bus in 1983 cases.
Did you bring a 1983 action in this case?
No, we did not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Fain, good morning to you.
May it please the court. Audrey Savane on behalf of Langley Productions, Inc., the cross appellee in this matter. The sole issue on appeal between the City of Omaha and Langley Productions, Inc. concerns the indemnification provision in the filming agreement. The filming agreement itself is only 3 pages long, and the indemnification provision of the filming agreement is found at section 5. The district court found that the indemnity provision was ambiguous, and as a result, the indemnity provision did not contain clear and unequivocal language to show that the parties intended for Langley Productions to indemnify the city against the city's own negligence. This honorable court should affirm the decision of the district court and determine that as a matter of law, the indemnity provision does not require Langley to indemnify the City of Omaha for the City of Omaha's own negligence. Generally, an agreement to indemnify is construed using similar contract principles that we use with any other contract. But there's one exception, And that's that there is a presumption that parties do not intend to indemnify other parties for those parties' own negligence. In order to overcome the presumption, in this case, the City of Omaha would have to show that there's either express language in the indemnity provision that Langley Productions was going to indemnify the city for the city's own negligence, or they have to show that the language clearly and unequivocally shows that Langley intended to indemnify the city for its own negligence.
For what did Langley intend to indemnify the city?
Langley intended to indemnify the city for actions arising out of Langley's negligence.
Their employees injuring somebody or being negligent or damaging property.
Right. Either Langley's actions or in the actions of any of its employees. And the reason that we know that is because when we look at the provision as a whole, the second subset includes that limitation. Otherwise, Langley would be agreeing to indemnify the City of Omaha during the entire period that the filming agreement was taking place.
Does that raise issues like assumption of the risk and contributory negligence? And did you indemnify for those things?
Well, in this case, there's been no accusations that the city of, or that Langley itself was negligent in any way. All of the negligence.
Did the case get that far?
Well, the issue of whether or not the indemnity provision required them to indemnify for the city's negligence was decided at the summary judgment stage. It was decided as a matter of law just based on the four corners of the document. So I guess I'm unsure if there would have been accusations or evidence that came to light as to whether or not there was an assumption of the risk or contributory negligence on behalf of Langley or its employees. The city asked that the court construe each of the parts of the indemnity provision separately based on where the semicolons are used. If that's done, then again, it means that Langley was agreeing that it would be indemnifying for injury or death, for any injury or death that happened during the times, the term of the agreement itself. It's not tied to any kind of acts or omissions on behalf of Langley. It also doesn't make sense when you read the second or third portions, again, if you're using the semicolon as the dividing mark, then the second provision doesn't have any meaning because you're not starting it out with the obligation of Langley to indemnify the city. It all has to be read together in order for it to make sense. Otherwise, it leads to an absurd result.
Who put the semicolons in the agreement? Do we know?
I do not know who put the semicolons in. I do know that the agreement was negotiated between the parties and that there were changes made to that provision. So at some point there was a semicolon inserted.
Several. Yes.
Yes. And that's the only provision that contains semicolons in the agreement itself. But again, if those semicolons are read as periods, as opposed to read as commas, then the entire indemnity provision doesn't make sense anymore. And the cases that are relied on by the City of Omaha, there's two different cases. In both of those situations, neither of the indemnity provisions had express language. So this court had to look at whether or not there was clear and equivocal intent that the parties wanted to indemnify the other for their own negligence. In the first case, Odo versus Speedway, the court looked at specific language that talked about an exception for gross negligence or willful misconduct. In this case, there's no exception for gross negligence or willful misconduct that would suggest the parties intended for Langley to indemnify the city for the city's own negligence. Again, there's no issue here that there's not express language, so the city has to rely on the fact or rely on the argument that there's clear and unequivocal language. The district court actually found that this provision was ambiguous. In order for a provision to be ambiguous, it has to be susceptible to construction, to reasonable constructions. We would argue in this case that the provision is clear. Langley is agreeing to indemnify the city for Langley's negligence, but there's no, again, express or unequivocal language that it's agreeing to indemnify the city for the city's own negligence. We have that higher presumption with an indemnity provision. If there are no further questions from the court, I'd like to thank you for your time and ask this court affirm the decision of the district court and find that as a matter of law, the indemnity provision does not contain the clear and unequivocal language necessary to overcome the presumption that Langley Productions did not intend to indemnify the city for the city's own negligence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that includes everybody's argument time. The city doesn't have any time left, does it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. That does conclude arguments today. Council, thank you very much for being here today on Dion versus City of Omaha.